This is the Anderson Files on PodClip. The Anderson Files is a look at commerce, investment, economics, and retirement issues that affect each and every one of you. Your host is Mike Anderson, Executive Vice President, Retirement Services, and partner of Finestone Partners. Finestone Partners is an independent firm with securities offered through Four Point Capital. And now your host, Mike Anderson.
Tax controversy issues. What's happening currently? With me today to discuss are Ernest Howard, CPA, and Corey Steigel, tax attorney. Ernest Howard has been in practice for 43 years, is a widely known and highly respected Los Angeles-based CPA, and closely engaged with CalCPA. Corey Steigel is a principal with Hockman, Salkin, Tosher Perez in Los Angeles. Corey is a certified specialist, taxation law, the State Bar of California, Board of Legal Specialization, and CPA licensed in California. He's the past president of the Los Angeles chapter of CalCPA. His firm is recognized internationally for its excellence in handling all aspects of sophisticated tax controversies and criminal tax matters. Gentlemen, good morning. Welcome.
Good morning.
To get started, the IRS is probably going to be looking more closely at high-income taxpayers. Who's going to be audited? Who are they going to be focused on?
Well, one of the items that they've publicized is going to be very high in focus is high-income non-filers. I have a couple right now that we're trying to hurry up and get 5, 6, 7 years worth of returns filed just so that they're going to be handled by the time this process gets going. You hear that it's going to be defending a lot of people that don't get caught up in time, and they are the expert in defending people that are about to be on the chopping block.
If you listen to the IRS, they'll tell you they'll be in every neighborhood, so to speak. High income, low income as well. But when you look at the recent emphasis, we definitely anticipate being busy with wealthy taxpayer audits.
Are there multiple taxpayer audit programs focused on the high earners that are going to be coming into play?
There definitely are, and there's distinctions between the different programs that are important. And you know, you hear these numbers, and it is somewhat of a moving target, but there, for high-income filers, there's at least three programs. One is your, let's just say, small business, where it's over $1 million of income. Once you get up over $10 million, then you have large business and international revenue agents doing the audits. And then they have a special program, Global High Wealth, for those taxpayers that have tens of millions of income. So it could be any one of those. But then again, you hear the administration, when they're looking at the increased IRS budget, talking about earners over $400,000 or the high-income non-filers over $100,000. So there are different programs, but at the end of the day, all groups of taxpayers are going to get audited, but particularly high-income.
And regarding criminal penalties, do the two of you see this being an issue coming out of these audits?
Definitely it's going to be a focus in the appropriate cases. The IRS recently set up a new Office of Fraud Enforcement, and that's going to enhance that as well.
And basically, you know, for CPAs and tax preparers, you know, if suddenly somebody shows up at your door having interest in one of your clients, and they happen to have a badge and they carry a gun, it would be good to ask if they're special agents, and if so, immediately stop talking and call Corey, because you want to have a lawyer involved. And in criminal matters, it's important, not just any lawyer is what you need. I've seen cases where lawyers that were not experienced and knowledgeable in the areas of criminal defense and rules of evidence have buried taxpayers by inadvertent disclosures that were very damaging and impossible to turn over later on. so that if there are the special agents, as they're called with the IRS or Treasury, you definitely need a very competent tax criminal defense lawyer. And of course, Corey's firm is the preeminent firm in the country there in that area.
Yeah, and with the new Office of Fraud Enforcement, we're seeing or they're describing an increased coordination between the departments. So if you get a civil non-criminal revenue agent that makes a referral for either fraud or perhaps criminal fraud, whereas before maybe that revenue agent put a lot of time in and then the referral wasn't accepted, with perhaps an increasingly robust fraud department there, it may be more well received, and if referred and if further referred for prosecution, perhaps taken up. So there's definitely been an uptick, and this could both be in audits or also referrals from collection, where many of the referrals have been coming from. So if you have multiple years of noncompliance, knowingly omitting income, or just indicators that show that the taxpayer knew that they were either underpaying or evading payment of tax, those could be potential referrals.
For the normal tax preparer who's handling an audit, if suddenly the auditor disappears for a while, or he seems to be digging in directions that look like they're looking for unreported income, maybe some documents that might appear to have been altered, it's okay to say at some point, is this leaning towards a fraud referral? And if so, then very important that you involve counsel at that point and basically start to, be careful as to everything that, the attorney should be the one who spoon feeds the auditor from there forward.
The best time to address a potential criminal issue is before any audit. And beyond the original filed return, which should be accurate, there are different programs to go ahead and voluntarily disclose positions to the IRS. And if done timely, meaning before the IRS gets information or before the audit starts, perhaps you could mitigate both your civil penalty as well as your criminal risk. So thinking through that.
Aware, too, that just simply not failing to file returns for more than 3 years, when it's shown to be willful, and the numbers are significant, that can turn into potential criminal issues. So, it's important to not let things sit, to be proactive and get things done before they become serious problems.
I'm chatting with Ernest Howard, CPA, and Corey Steigel, tax attorney, on current tax controversy issues, and this is the Anderson Files on podclips.io. Moving to another subject as far as residency audits, both federal and California, what are the sourcing issues that are involved here?
Well, I've run into this. I had a small client who moved to Washington State from California, but he was a graphic designer, and he continued to work for one of his former clients or one of his clients here in California, and got a 1099 reporting income from California. And since he was living in Washington, we didn't believe we needed to file a return for California. And California caught up with it and said, nope, income's from California, you owe the tax. And it turns out they won on that issue. So where the benefit of the service being rendered is in California or in any other state whose rules are similar to California's, then you do have a requirement to file a non-resident return and report income to that state. Another big issue is what determines residency. See, tons of people are leaving California, and yet they're still keeping their home here. And if you continue to own a home, that is evidence to California that you haven't left, so they're going to want to treat you like you're still a resident here and still fully taxable here. So when you move, it's important that you get new driver's license, get new insurance, register to vote in the new area, have established a residence where you have utilities in your name, and all of the bells and whistles that show that that's where you're living, and pretty much sever all of those things with California. A failure to do so will leave a lingering vulnerability to a California tax residency audit that could hit you up for some money.
And when you think of residency, there's really two issues. There's where are you domiciled, and this is for California purposes, where are you domiciled and where is your residency? And the way I think of that is domicile is where your heart is or where you're going to return to wherever you're at. Residency is where you're at, more of where you're at in a particular year, as far as number of days and different facts and circumstances. But the tricky part is it comes down to subjective intent, what's in that person's mind. And like Ernest said, you go through all the facts and circumstances. It could be anything, driver's license. They like to look at where the kids are. And the taxpayers just can't seem to get rid of their homes if they're going to move to another state. Those are all indicators that maybe they're not leaving permanently, not moving their domicile, or maybe that, you know, subjectively they're only away for a transitory or temporary purpose. And the other thing is with post-COVID, there's just unique working arrangements. Perhaps somebody's staying with family in Washington or staying in California, and it's going to raise very interesting factual questions. And those audit years for California with the four-year statute of limitation, we're going to be seeing those for years to come, and then we'll know how those issues play out.
Yeah, I've seen several situations over the last year where a client's residency changes legitimately. They've moved to another state, but their business remains domicile in California. I've seen several examples of this. Do you need to be careful with that scenario?
You do. And as Ernest mentioned earlier, there's two, even if you as an individual are domiciled in another state, if your business or you are earning income sourced to California, that California source business income or services income, whatever it is, may still be subject to California tax, which you need to put on a non-resident return. And then just another thing to think about, and it may be a gray area as far as is sourcing, is even if you don't think you have California source income from that business that still has a connection there or whatever it is, file a return. File your non-resident return so at least you start that statute of limitations. Otherwise, the STB may have forever to kick the tires on residency.
And I see cases where they regularly go back as much as 20 years. And in fact, your firm referred somebody to me a few years ago in that situation. Thankfully, we were able to turn it off. But, you know, finding information that's 18 years old can be an adventure.
Tax controversy. Ernest Howard, CPA, and Corey Steigel, tax attorney, tell us what we need to know. This is the Anderson Files on podclips.io. Let's take a look at crypto and virtual currency issues. Is it really that important to check that crypto box on your 1040?
Well, not failing to check it, and if you're later found to have had income that you didn't report, it's a willful violation, which ratchets the penalties up much more significantly. And if the numbers can be large enough, potentially criminal, so that if you have any cryptocurrency, check that box. And if you know, that crypto is so complex that I would definitely work with the exchange because they have programs that will help you compute what your gains and losses are. And like with Bitcoin Cash, that's income that is like interest or dividend income. But it doesn't have the advantages of dividend income, so that you want to make sure that any income gets reported and that you've notified the IRS that you have this. As I understand it, they are auditing. They're getting John Doe summonses against the exchanges, and if you have cryptocurrency and don't report it, the IRS will find you. There's almost no doubt of that in the long run. What's your thought, Corey?
They will find you. That's right. And there's been some very current developments on that. Back to check in the box. Yes. 10 years ago or 15 years ago, people perhaps didn't focus as much as they should have on Schedule B, where there was a box asking about foreign bank accounts. Fast forward 5-10 years, those became criminal cases where appropriate. So here, there's this question that's right there on the front. You sign your return under penalty of perjury. You got to look at every question, and you're treated as if you read it and when you answered those questions. So absolutely, there's a taxpayer advocate, IRS taxpayer advocate blog post that really does a good job of going through some of the issues related to checking that box, because it does specify certain circumstances. And you know, Ernest, wisely said, well, perhaps you'd err on the side of checking it, but they go through some good fact patterns of, you know, perhaps when you do or don't, and how it could be confusing. But either way you come to it, you're signing that return. You better read the question and answer it correctly. As far as whether they'll find you, there even today there was a in this bipartisan infrastructure bill that's pending. One of the things that they're looking at is additional informational reporting, and this would be by the exchanges. There were some amendments today actually proposed to find who's a broker who needs to report this information in the legislation. But so basically what the service is looking to do is basically shift the approach so that they get the information, just like on a W-2 or your bank gives 1099 information, so that, you know, the interest goes directly to the IRS, the information. Perhaps now some of that crypto information, if this is passed, will go to the IRS as well. So assume they're going to know.
And actually, there are some brokerage firms that will even handle everything and file 1099s for you on this. So that is a direction that things are going, although they also charge you fees for that. So keep that in balance as you look at how you handle your accounts if you decide to invest in cryptocurrencies.
Absolutely. And calculating that crypto income correctly, need to be very careful for that activity within a calendar year.
It's best to work with somebody who's knowledgeable in the handling of cryptocurrencies, and to get one of the exchanges and or the service that they work with that will calculate your taxable income amounts so that you know you're doing it right.
Exactly. Turning to partnerships and S-Corp basis audits. The problem with calculating an older entity's basis, is that a real challenge?
In some cases, it's flat out impossible, and you've just got to, you know, make reasonable assumptions and attach a disclosure to your tax return that's what you're doing, because of the unavailability of information. And then once you've done that and gone forward 3 or 4 or 5 years, you know, it'll become history, and you'll just go and sin no more, basically. But this is a big area because, you know, a lot of accountants aren't totally competent in tracking, let's say not necessarily accountants, but tax preparers aren't talented in the area of tracking basis in partnerships and S corporations. And you know, when you have income triggering events, that basis becomes a relevant component. You want to basically be doing it right, and you know, the problem is if you start doing it the wrong way, you might actually have to get IRS approval to change it down the road, because it might be a change in accounting method that IRS has rules on changing from, even sometimes when you're not doing it right. So I would definitely, you know, make sure that whoever is working with your partnership returns knows what they're doing and is doing the best job possible in this area. And the other thing is that when you're preparing returns and you're getting K-1s from others, make sure that they're giving you the basis worksheet and that it's not unreasonable on its face, so that you at least can say you relied on what appeared to be reasonable information in preparing the tax return.
So basically what you need to do is rely on indirect methods and effectively reconstruct what was, you know, put into the partnership or S-Corp, or even if it's, say, a house that was sold, and proving the basis, going back 20 years and looking what was acquired, or perhaps where did the money come from? Maybe it came from a wedding gift or something, but you're basically going back and reconstructing what they should have done 20 years ago to track where the money came from and how it went into the entity.
You know, and a problem that happens here is what's a very simplistic example. Let's say three people come together and form a partnership to develop some real estate, and one person bought some real estate 20 years before and had a cost of a couple thousand dollars, but it's now worth a couple hundred thousand. And as he contributes it to the new partnership that they formed to develop this real estate, the accountant, you know, takes the fair market value at the date contributed and puts that on the books, and then the tax preparer who comes along and takes the books just plugs it in. Well, you know, basically you've got an overstatement of your basis there, because you've got to go back to that original cost. And while you may need to give him the benefit of, you know, how much of the partnership he owns on the one hand, on the other hand, you know, you have to recognize gain based on what the original cost was, not on what that subsequent fair market value was.
And turning to PPP loan audit, something new on the horizon. What are the issues here?
Well, you know, A, did people qualify, you know, and B, did they use them to pay the proper expenses that are allowable to have the PPP loan forgiven? You know, a lot of people are falsifying, well, not necessarily intentionally, but are not understanding the rules and are you know, using expenses from outside the allowable period, or expenses that aren't part of the allowable type. And the IRS is definitely going to be looking at this. And when they start to spot trends, you will see drastically increased audit activity in those areas. You know, and some people are going to really play fast and loose, and Corey is going to be the one they're going to need to help them when they get caught.
Definitely. They made some early examples of really bad actors. I mean, and these are situations where employees were just, say, made up and stuck on the application in order to get the eligible. And just recently, the IRS on a panel described they had already initiated about 500 of the fraud investigations, resulting in more than 200 indictments. And so far, 20 have already gone forward to sentencing. And of those, of the convicted, the average prison time is about 3 years. So they're already making the examples up front to let people know they're looking at it. But like Ernest said, you could expect more. And if they see tranches of abuse, you know, expect those to get looked at, particularly with the increased use of data analytics and other things. I think that's on the horizon for us.
You know, actually, if you think about it, you know, a key element of law enforcement, because they can't catch everybody, is to catch egregious bad doers. And make it so that a lot of people hear about it. You know, going back 1,000 years ago, somebody who was an evil perpetrator would be put in stock so that everyone coming in and out of the town would see them there. Well, nowadays they basically sentence you to 1 to 3 in Club Fed, and basically make sure it makes at least the second or third page of the Times and the Daily Journal.
Yeah, and there's some places that still use those stocks, I'm guessing.
Well, if we're talking about China, they've got even worse methods, but that's another story.
Exactly. Turning to tax return due diligence and penalties, do taxpayers need to be especially careful about increased child credits and the monitoring and from the IRS?
Well, I have a CPA friend who calls some areas of tax where the IRS has built lots of penalties as taxation by booby trap. And you know, in the end, you know, people's misbehaviors need to be spanked or punished in some way. But, you know, you don't want to have the death penalty for stealing a $2 candy bar. So basically, you know, for tax preparers, if you are deducting or taking credits for child care, just the basic child credit or the earned income credit, and earned income credit is sort of like a welfare paid through the tax return. And it's not that well understood by the less sophisticated preparers, so that you've actually got to answer pages of questionnaires and put notes in the file documenting that you've asked specific questions of your client. And if you've said you've asked something that you haven't, or said that you had a document proving that a child lived with someone where you didn't have it, you know, there's over a $500 per violation penalty there. And it's interesting in that an attorney friend of ours was defending a CPA up in Northern California, north of here, and he was being hit with $10,000 worth of penalties where he had properly claimed all the credits that his clients were entitled to. None of them were incorrect, but he had not done the due diligence, where he didn't have the documentation to prove it, and they were still able to penalize him, even though, you know, he had, you know, only deducted or taken credits in cases where they should have been allowed. So in the end, this is a failure to document penalty, even where the underlying situation is innocent.
On that point, and this goes for anything, not just earned income tax credits, child credits, refundable credits, but when you're filling out that due diligence form and you're indicating that you have a certain substantiation to show that you're entitled to it, anytime you put a number on the return, you should be thinking about what document do you have to support that number on the return, or the question asked that you're answering on the return. And the same definitely goes for due diligence. And from the IRS's perspective, when they're dealing with perhaps, you know, high volume return preparing shops where people go in early in the filing season to get their refundable credits, yes, you can audit person by person, but you could also audit the preparer. So from a preparer perspective, you need to make sure you have that, not just the due diligence form, but the documents that underlie it. Otherwise, you could look at potentially losing your E-10 or your P-10, which are the things that utilize to file the returns. And the IRS is looking for even further authority on regulating E-10.
As we wrap up, I see coming up on the calendar the Cal CPA Tax Trek Conference is on the horizon. Can you tell us a little bit about that and the dates?
Yes, I'm on the planning committee for the subject matter in the Tax Trek Conference, and it is a very high-level, very sophisticated tax update of very important current issues. It'll be the Wednesday, Thursday, the week before Thanksgiving, so it'll be that Wednesday, Thursday of the 11th, November 17th and 18th. And then an additional conference on real estate taxes on the 19th, that Friday. These are fantastic programs, and for people in the tax preparation business or tax planning or, you know, transactional tax lawyers, I highly recommend this program. It's as good as it gets. And some of the subjects out there will be talking about what's going beyond in the area of virtual currency. Some of the developments that are going to be coming down the road, and then followed up by that will be the IRS perspective on crypto, how they're going to be progressing with enforcement, their investigations, and other issues there. We're also going to have a Washington tax update where we'll have somebody from Washington. There'll be a partnership update. California and federal overall tax update. And the keynote speaker on the first day at lunch will be Commissioner Rettig. So he's going to tell us what's going on. So he's not somebody you can easily hear from, and this will be a chance for that. There'll be an overview of some new enforcement areas and aggressive tax structures and strategies. Some COVID-19 tax changes lingering beyond the expiration dates. And then Prop 19, California's Prop 19, taxation when everything burns. And several other areas that Corporate Transparency Act and FinCEN, the foreign bank account update, and tax practice and conduct standards. So as you can see, it's a pretty awesome program and not information you can get from most tax update programs. This is sophistication on a higher level that will really get you well-armed to understand the world we're practicing in.
And for our listeners to learn more and to contact each of you, what's the best way, Ernest Corey, for listeners to do that? What's the best way to contact you?
Well, just go to my website, which is my initials, efhcpa.com, and all of our contact information there. You can call the office and talk to my assistant, and they'll set up an appointment. Or you could email me at the email, my first name, Ernest@efhcpa.com. And, that'll work.
And Corey?
And for me, you could just go to our website as well, taxlitigator.com.
For the Tax Trek Conference, you can go to the CalCPA website, which is www.calcpa.org, and look at the continuing education programs. And look up on the dates of November 17th, 18th, and 19th, and you'll see those programs, and you can actually sign up right online.
Excellent, excellent. Thank you for sharing that, Ernest. Ernest, Corey, thank you so much for the conversation. It was highly important and of great value to our listeners. Thank you, Daryl Wayne, engineer, Mark Allen, producer. I'm Mike Anderson. And this is the Anderson Files on podclips.io, powered by InfoGen Labs, Inc. Keep calm and keep listening.
You've been listening to the Anderson Files with Mike Anderson. Visit us at podclip.io and check on the financial box for more information on the Anderson Files.